This is an ABC Radio National podcast. For full details, abc.net.au/rn.
Beloved listeners, gladdies and poddies alike, to another LNL. And I'm now going to tell you a trade secret. We don't use an ordinary studio like other programs. We broadcast regularly from the Donald O. Hebb's experimental cubicle. This was constructed about half a century ago at McGill University in Montreal, and we've had it lovingly copied here at the ABC, because I find it it's a sensory deprivation tank, and I find that with a little sensory deprivation, the brain acts up in the strangest possible ways. And on this occasion, I'm joined in this cubicle by a fellow called Alfred W. McCoy. Now, Alfred, before I tell them why we're in here together, you're the J.R.W. Smale Professor of History at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Pray tell, who was J.R.W. Smale?
Brilliant, erudite professor of history, my predecessor at the University of Wisconsin as a Southeast Asian historian. And then he, not only did he have a superb career, but at the end, he got that disease that more than any mocks the life of the mind, Alzheimer's. And his family, at a time when the disease had some stigma attached to it, allowed him to be photographed, the distinguished Professor Smale, strapped in a wheelchair with a bicycle helmet, slumped over, drooling. And so I named the chair both to honor his career and also to honor the courage of the family who tried to break that stigma by publicizing the disease and using their father and their husband as a kind of case.
I ask visiting academics to identify their named chair, and that's the best story, the most moving story we've ever had in response. Good on you. Now, a few weeks ago, dear listener, a few more of those appalling photos from Abu Ghraib were released. They dated back to 2003, included happy snaps of six corpses as well as hooded detainees in stress positions. Now, to date, only very low-ranking U.S. military personnel have been charged with any crimes at Abu Ghraib, and the line has always been that it was a few bad apples that sullied the reputation of the U.S. in that hellhole. Of course, others have loudly protested that this ain't necessarily so, and have pointed the finger onward and upward to, again and again, to the likes of Rumsfeld. Anyway, tonight we'll unravel some of the history of the interrogation techniques used by the CIA at Abu Ghraib. And Alfred W. McCoy, Al, did some groundbreaking work in the 70s on the CIA's complicity in the global heroin trade, and that's when I first got to know about him. That work almost got him killed. He spent a decade in Australia. He wrote a terrific book about organised crime and the heroin trade in this country. And these days, Al is the professor of Southeast Asian history at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. The new book is called A Question of Torture, CIA Interrogation from the Cold War to the War on Terror. Al, welcome back.
Thanks.
Would you be kind enough to, before we look at the Abu Ghraib pictures again, to tell the listener the significance of this cubicle wherein we are squeezed? Tell us why it matters that in the 1950s a sensory deprivation chamber was commissioned at a Montreal university.
Sure. In June 1951, there was a meeting between the head of the United Kingdom Defence Research Board, the legendary Sir Henry Tizard, a man who during World War II had mobilized applied physics for things such as radar, making it a key Allied weapon in victory, and to a lesser extent, applied physics for the nuclear bomb. In 1951, he came back to the United States, and this time he was mobilizing behavioral scientists for a war of the mind against the Soviet Union. And he launched, in collaboration with the Canadian Defense Research Board and top scientists from the CIA, who met in a motel room in Montreal at the Ritz-Carlton Hotel, they launched a veritable Manhattan Project of the mind that expended up to $1 billion a year trying to crack the code of human consciousness. And all of us have heard about the most outrageous and least successful of these experiments, the CIA's experiments with LSD, their hiring of prostitutes and operation of party houses and drugging summer camps and prisons and all the rest. All of that highly sensational, well-reported stuff, in fact, was, in terms of research, a dead end. It produced nothing, no useful methods. The real breakthroughs came in the mundane area of behavioral research, all outsourced to leading universities, Harvard, Princeton, Yale, McGill. And there were three breakthroughs among the literally hundreds of experiments conducted. The first and most important came at McGill University under the supervision of Dr. Donald O'Hebb, who was a legendary and brilliant behavioral scientist, one of the greatest of his generation. There are parts of the brain named after him. Hebbian is a whole approach. There's a Freudian and Hebbian approach to the study of the mind. And as a part of his work, he was contracted by the Canadian Defense Research Board. And what he did was he found that he could induce psychosis, a state akin to psychosis, in just 48 hours without drugs, electroshock, hypnosis, all of the exotic techniques that the CIA was then applying. And all he did was have student volunteers sit in an air-conditioned cubicle with goggles, gloves, and earmuffs. And that within 48 hours, they'd pass through hallucinations, and those who could stand it would make it all the way to the end, would suffer a state akin to psychosis.
The chapter on this is absolutely fascinating, and as you say, the manifestations of disturbance were quite spectacular and very fast.
Extraordinarily quickly. Nobody touching them, under very pleasant circumstances, being paid minimum wages, some of them very stable people. For example, the one subject I've been able to track down later became quite a distinguished neurologist himself. I mean, a lot of these were medical students, so these were, you know, well selected carefully.
And they knew that ultimately they were safe, and yet this happened.
Right, they knew they could walk at any time.
No electroshock, no truth serum, no beating, no pain.
No touch torture. That was the discovery that led to no touch torture. Now, simultaneously in the mid-1950s at Cornell University Medical Center in New York, one of our greatest research institutions, two eminent neurologists studied for the CIA KGB torture techniques, and they discovered that the most useful and the most savage of all the KGB techniques were not the beatings and the like, but simply making the subject stand immobile for days at a time, arms extended. And they found that self-inflicted pain produced a devastating impact. The legs, the fluids flow down the legs swell, sores form, the sores separate, the kidneys shut down, hallucinations start. And the combination of these two techniques, self-inflicted pain and sensory deprivation, were codified by the CIA in the Kubark Counterintelligence Interrogation Manual in 1963. And that's the foundational document.
Okay, let's, having established that elemental truth, let's go back to Abu Ghraib. When you look at the pictures, you see a 50-year history of CIA torture. You don't see a few rotten apples, do you? You don't see an isolated case of aberrant, undisciplined behavior at all.
No. And that's what, in fact, got me to write this book. When those photos were first released in 2004, I had just finished nearly 20 years of work on torture, in this case studying the impact of torture upon the Philippine Armed Forces. And in my book on that subject, I had one paragraph about the CIA psychological method, which had been transmitted to the Philippine military and had been the basic method they'd used for torture interrogation of the Marcos regime. The topic was so sordid and demoralizing that I'd given it away and promised myself that I wouldn't work on that ever again. But then when the photographs from Abu Ghraib came out and everybody was saying, William Sapphire, for example, writing the New York Times, these are creeps. Others said recycled hillbillies from Cumberland, Maryland. I looked at those photographs and I saw the men were hooded for sensory disorientation and their arms were extended and they were standing immobile for self-inflicted pain. And you can see that all the way through. More and more photographs we get, the pattern's clear. The latest photographs...
So they look exactly like the student volunteers of Dr. Hebb.
Actually, they look exactly like them, but the people that look even more precisely so are the Guantanamo detainees, because they wear the goggles, those earmuffs, and the gloves, which you see them very often in the photographs. That's it precisely.
Now, dark minds, like great minds, think alike. You've talked about the KGB coming to similar or indeed identical conclusions during the Cold War. This stuff must be a bit hard to dig up. How did you... And there are multitudes of footnotes in the book. How did you get onto this stuff?
Well, by virtue of the internet, for example, you can get most of this stuff. If you want to get an original copy of the CIA's interrogation manual, the 1963 Kubark manual, your listeners can just go to their computers, boot up Google, and type in KUBARK, and you'll have it right on your screen.
There it is.
And same thing with the Human Resources Exploitation Manual, 1983. Which is a CIA training manual used to train the Honduran military in these same techniques. And then you can also type in Lieutenant General Ricardo Sanchez, and you'll get his September 2003 orders for extraordinary methods, extreme methods beyond those allowed by the U.S. Army Field Manual. And if you line those all up, as I did in my book, and you actually read the text and compare the text, what you'll find is there's a striking similarity from 1963 to 1983 all the way up to 2003 in Iraq.
The last time you and I talked was in Adelaide, and as you know, the writers' thing's on, and there's a festival. And one of the events, as I understand it, is a musical comedy around the Marcoses, around Imelda, who's presented as a very sympathetic, somewhat zany creature. It's good to remind people that the Marcos years were not musical comedy. They were very nasty.
Brutal. The Philippines was right up there with Chile for human rights abuses. 3,000 dead, 30,000 tortured, 70,000 incarcerated. A brutal regime of which Imelda was a key figure.
This is LNL on ABC Radio National, Radio Australia, online and via podcast, and I'm talking to Professor Alfred W. McCoy about his book, A Question of Torture, CIA Interrogation from the Cold War to the War on Terror. Tell us how the CIA refined its torture techniques through the Kennedy era in Central America and Southeast Asia. They worked through the very benign-sounding organization USAID.
That's right. After the CIA codified this new technique in its Kubark manual in 1963, the CIA then disseminated the techniques worldwide for the next 30 years, throughout the balance of the Cold War. And it did so in two phases. From the early 1960s right up to 1974, it disseminated them through USAID, U.S. Agency for International Development, Office of Public Safety. This was a worldwide police training program, improved traffic management, improved fingerprinting, records keeping, and the like. And beneath that benign facade, the CIA also operated a torture training program for selecting elite officers to torture dissidents, for example, you know, the Tupamaros in Uruguay, the resistance to the military regime in Brazil, etc. And in 1974, the U.S. Congress got wind of the fact that the Office of Public Safety had been engaged in torture training. And led by Senator William Fulbright and Senator Abarask of South Dakota, they zeroed out, they destroyed the Office of Public Safety. But unfortunately,
I wish there were a few more Fulbrights around today.
Indeed.
Yeah.
What happened, however, is they'd lopped off the head of the beast. They'd left the body behind, and the body regenerated a head. What the CIA did was it then penetrated U.S. Army training teams, and it began to use U.S. Army training teams in Latin America. And it did it through mobile training teams and through the later notorious School of the Americas, and they transmitted these techniques. The other thing that happened, too, and this is little known that I detail in the book, the Army set up in 1966 a project that ran through the U.S. Army Intelligence Command parallel to the CIA effort, indicating that the techniques not only were proliferated worldwide, but they were disseminated throughout the U.S. intelligence community. And the U.S. Army ran a thing called, literally, I kid you not, Project X. Project X ran from 1966 to 1991, 25 years. And at the U.S. Army Intelligence Command, based in Fort Huachuca, Arizona, what they did was they developed a complete counterinsurgency curriculum with over 200 correspondence courses, In the realm of counterintelligence and interrogation, they had a three-tier curriculum, sort of intelligence, interrogation 101, sort of the theory, then they went to seminars, then advanced practicums. They codified these findings in manuals, which they mailed out literally by the thousands, translated into Spanish, transmitting the lessons of the Phoenix program in South Vietnam, where the CIA had run a nationwide interrogation program through 40-plus interrogation centers that left, according to the CIA's own counting, 20,000 extrajudicial executions. And they transmitted the lessons of this campaign through Project X from South Vietnam to Latin America.
I'm just looking at the notes here. It's just one figure. By 1971, over a million police officers in 47 nations had been trained. 85,000 in Vietnam, 100,000 in Brazil. This was an immense project.
Absolutely immense.
Was the budget hidden from Congress?
No, Office of Public Safety was actually wide open. This was an express program. That's why Congress was able to destroy it in 1974-75.
Okay, let's go back to the ancient world for inspiration. Ancient Athens, the Spanish Inquisition, etc. There's always been torture, and there's always been a tendency therefrom to produce unreliable results. I mean, understandably, people will say anything to make it stop, and very strong people just stay silent no matter what sort of pain is inflicted on them. So do the CIA's methods produce what can be called actionable intelligence?
Generally, no. In the 3rd century AD, a Roman jurist who had lots of experience of torture, because all slaves and many freemen who came before Roman courts had, as a matter of course, to be tortured. And Ulpian wrote in his legal commentaries of the 3rd century AD, 1,800 years ago, he said, "Torture is a difficult and dangerous thing. The strong will resist, and the weak will say anything to end the pain." And we have learned, despite the increasing sophistication of our techniques, the continuing truth of Ulpian's dictum. We can just pick one example. Right after the war on terror started, the FBI was stripped of its traditional counterintelligence role because the FBI won't torture, and the Bush administration wanted to torture. And so they assigned control over the Al-Qaeda captives right after 9/11 to the CIA because they couldn't would torture. And one of the first captured was the man who operated a training camp in Afghanistan for Al-Qaeda, a man named Al-Libi. The CIA tortured him. They waterboarded him for 2 weeks. And he gave detailed information alleging that Saddam Hussein's regime had trained Al-Qaeda in chemical and biological weapons. Colin Powell went before the United Nations in February 2003 on the eve of our invasion of Iraq and told the world that we had verified intelligence that Saddam Hussein's government had trained Al-Qaeda in chemical and biological weapons. A year later, after Powell was embarrassed by this, the CIA released a formal finding that Al-Libi was a fabricator, and they withdrew all the intelligence reports based on his information.
Years ago, when he was still a famous civil libertarian, Alan Dershowitz, the U.S. lawyer, academic, used to appear on the program, and I noticed a recent book he brought out, just giving a pragmatic case for torture. Alan supported its use, regulated by warrants and controls, in the cases where there is the so-called ticking time bomb. His argument is, just say there's a terrorist attack, a lot of people have been killed in a major city, they capture one of the terrorists who says, guess what, there's another bomb out there, it's going to kill a lot more people, but I'm not going to tell you where it is. What do you think of the Dershowitz argument? Would torture be effective in that scenario?
Well, first of all, you have to understand the context of Dershowitz's argument. With the Twin Towers collapsing, the idea of a nuclear bomb in Times Square, the hypothesis, the fantasy, resonates so powerfully with the reality that people, when they hear the ticking time bomb scenario in the current debate, shut down immediately. And also, it's reprised on our television screens. NYPD Blue had variations of it.
24
does it every week.
All the time.
Yeah. And it's the same thing. They have a ticking bomb. One of their latest episodes was ticking, was gas canister bombs are going to go off in L.A., and Agent Jack Bauer pulls out his knife and sticks it up to the eyeball of a of a White House operative that has information, he's going to cut his eyes out unless he talks. The man talks, and it goes on and on. It's every week. It's like the perils of Pauline. So that this scenario, in fact, has gained widespread credence because of the mass media. And people have not actually subjected this hypothesis, and it's just that, to a kind of rational examination because of its emotional power. When you actually think about it, let's imagine that first of all, that this most improbable scenario actually happened. Okay, we'd have to capture the terrorists at the precise moment between the time the bomb was set and the bomb was going off. Furthermore, among the 14 million people in the New York metropolitan area, we'd have to know that it's this precise person who's the terrorist. In short, we know everything...
Well, now, hang on. In the Dershowitz scenario, he's actually put his hand up and said, I know.
No, actually, Alan changes the scenario. He's been talking about this for years now. But so we've got him, and we know everything about him except for this one precise bit of information. And then further, we have to assume then that torture is the most effective way to extract the information. And everything we've learned about torture, particularly the torture of hardened activists, is that it redoubles their determination, their hatred of the torture and the regime the torture represents. So any chance you'd have, assume, in the highly improbable, wildly improbable circumstance that would in some way approximate the ticking bomb scenario, that you've got one shot, the bomb's going to go off, you torture the person, on the balance of probabilities, he's a militant, otherwise he wouldn't have done this, he's going to hate you even more, he's going to be less likely to give you information, right? Now, what Dershowitz and the others ignore, okay, when they construct this scenario, is there are alternatives. The scenario is constructed in a way that we're given a choice between tortured information and no information at all. It's as if this is the only viable method of interrogation. In fact, just as the CIA has developed this psychological torture over the past 50 years and created a distinctively American form of torture, so there is an even more venerable American form of interrogation, empathetic interrogation. It was developed by a Japanese missionary, Major Moran, during World War II in the Pacific Theater. The U.S. Marine Corps built an entire corps of Japanese-trained interrogators based on his success. And what they found that was at Saipan and Tinian in the last years of World War II, they could pick up Japanese soldiers who were thought to be fanatics, who were reared to believe the emperor was divine. Everything we say about Al-Qaeda today, we said about the Japanese soldiers back then. And within 24 hours, the Marine Corps consistently could get the most difficult kind of intelligence to get, detailed order of battle intelligence in 24 hours.
How?
Because of empathetic interrogation. Speak to them in Japanese, establish your humanity, establish a personal relationship with them, play upon the imbalance in power. After all, the interrogator has the power and the captive doesn't. So you've got an upper hand right away. And just work empathetically. Now, the FBI carried on this tradition after World War II. You'll notice that among all the allegations, the hundreds...
Not the FBI.
They don't torture. They never have tortured. Okay? The FBI ran the investigation of the bombing of the U.S. embassies in East Africa in the 1990s. They picked the people up. They interrogated them empathetically and legally. They got full confessions. Some of our best intelligence about Al-Qaeda, even today, comes from those FBI investigations. They then brought them before U.S. federal courts where these men willingly confessed. They were prosecuted because the interrogations had been conducted in law. And right now they're in jail serving out their terms. Okay. In other words, like all great crimes, there's an even greater crime, stupidity. The whole Bush administration's decision to torture it didn't have to be. There were and are alternatives.
Rumsfeld, U.S. Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld, famously wrote on a memo, "I stand at my desk for 8 hours a day. Why are we limiting standing positions to only 4 hours a day?" And some people have joked, of course, about how loud rock and roll music or rap music is blasted into cells. What's your message for Rumsfeld, who I suspect is listening?
Oh, that's actually that memo in December 2002 was a very important memo. And that marks a transition in the use of Guantanamo. Up to that point, for the first year, throughout 2002, when we began warehousing Al-Qaeda and terrorist suspects in that facility, they've been housed quite humanely. And what Wormsell did is he appointed a new commander, General Jeffrey Miller, okay, in order to increase...
He's a darling, isn't he?
Right, to increase the interrogation yield. Now, under General Miller, Guantanamo became a veritable behavioral science laboratory, a veritable torture laboratory. And under General Miller, we see the perfection of the CIA's torture paradigm. Now, everything we've described before, the hooding, the rock music, the stress positions, that's essentially a generic attack on the universal human sensory receptors, heat and cold, hunger and surfeit, dark and light. It's a surfeit and denial of sensory input. Okay. Now at Guantanamo, what they did is they carried it to step two. What they discovered was that they could increase the force of the attack if they went beyond this universal sensory receptors and they started attacking cultural identity. So that's when they played around with the nudity and the sexuality, discovering Arab male sensitivity to issues of sexuality and gender identity. And also the fear of dogs. Okay. Then they went to a third step. Instead of having psychologists simply design the paradigm, the interrogation techniques, what they did at Guantanamo was have properly trained psychologists, military psychologists, actually participate in the interrogation and discover individual fears and phobias. The net result is that this very elastic CIA psychological torture paradigm, in every one of its applications, sustained applications, produces innovation. And since this is one of the most sustained since 2001, we now have a perfection of the paradigm that combines a threefold assault: sensory receptors, second, cultural identity, third, individual fears and phobias.
Let's introduce another character to this drama, and that's John McCain. Just to remind listeners, he was the guy who might have been president, losing the 2000 Republican nomination to George Bush. He, of course, served in Vietnam, was captured, tortured by the Viet Cong for several years. The story is, in fact, I've long believed that he'd be a walk-up start to win for the Republicans, but he's got major health problems which come out of Vietnam and out of torture. So it's not surprising that he's tried to push through Congress some legislation to prevent it. What do you think of the McCain legislation, and will it prevent torture?
The McCain legislation is a tragedy. As introduced by Senator McCain, based on that experience you described, where he was brutally tortured by the North Vietnamese, McCain introduced a complete prohibition on all torture of any detainee held by any U.S. agency, civil or military, read CIA or military, anywhere in the world. If that legislation had been passed, as he drafted it, there would be a complete prohibition on torture. Guantanamo would be completely reorganized, if not closed down. One could go on and on about the potential implications of this. It would be over. We wouldn't be talking about this now. Or I'd be talking to you about a historian about how there had been this great crime in America, but American society, through its glories, it has corrected the crime. Unfortunately, what happened was the Bush White House twisted McCain's torture prohibition into a de facto legalization of torture, okay? And the net result has been to actually make the situation worse. What the Bush White House did was it essentially used the McCain torture ban to affirm, to legalize the three controversial conservative legal principles that it had used to order torture from the top, right from the start. Right after President Bush addressed the nation on September 11, 2001, he privately turned to his advisors and said, quote, "I don't care what the international lawyers say, we are going to kick some ass." And so his legal advisors had to then turn this illegal order and render it lawful through three controversial legal doctrines, which have since been affirmed by the White House by twisting the McCain torture ban. Doctrine one was the president and commander-in-chief can override all laws and treaties. When President Bush signed the McCain torture ban on December 30th last, he sent out an email presidential signing statement at 8 o'clock December 30th, before New Year's, the most obscure media time, of course, available. And he said that as commander-in-chief and as head of the unitary executive, I reserve the right to do what needs to be done. He affirmed that principle. Second, the Justice Department lawyers, when the CIA started torturing, crafted an exculpatory legal defense for CIA interrogators, and it had two areas. If a CIA interrogator tortures, okay, but thinks that his aim is to get information, intention is a defense, and he can walk. Second, what is torture? Torture is defined as severe physical and psychological pain. But what does severe mean? That's that notorious quote.
So, escape clauses.
Right, and so that McCain himself wrote one, and the third and the most controversial one, and this is the key one, is that right from the start, the Bush White House insisted that Guantanamo is not U.S. territory. Then, in 2004, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled in a landmark decision, Rasul v. Bush, that Guantanamo is U.S. territory, and thus habeas corpus applies. That allowed New York's top, most powerful corporate law firms to send battalions of lawyers shuttling to Guantanamo, filing 160 habeas corpus cases on behalf of 300 detainees. Now, what happened was President Bush got Senator Lindsey Graham, a movement conservative, to amend the McCain Amendment to the Defense Appropriation Bill. And that amendment said, for the purposes of this legislation, Guantanamo is not part of the territory of the United States. And then, since that law was signed, the Bush White House has marched into all three federal courts, district courts, appeal court, and Supreme Court, and ordered them to dismiss all of the habeas corpus cases.
The subject is a question of torture. The title of the book, the same. CIA Interrogation from the Cold War to the War on Terror. My guest is Alfred W. McCoy. The program is LNL on Radio National, Radio Australia, the World Wide Web, and your pod. And I want to do something a little bit discursive at this point. I got involved with Amnesty International decades ago, and one of the reasons I was impressed with it was its founding father had said, in passing, that one's compassion had to extend beyond the torturer to, beyond the person who was tortured, to the torturer. And this became vivid to me when someone brought in a documentary film to my office in Melbourne, which they couldn't sell to the ABC. And they showed it to me. The opening shot was that of a young Greek guy who looked, well, he looked like a saint on a, you know, on an icon. And he's talking in Greek and subtitled. And he's telling the story about him being a simple farm boy who's caught up in the general's takeover, and he's then progressively taught or required to torture. And he's on the screen, this saint, telling what he did to people, how he turned them into human vegetables. And as you do it, you realise that he couldn't be more monumentally stuffed himself. What do we know, Al, about what happens to the torturer over a period?
Very good question. First of all, it depends on the level that you're dealing with. The low down, the sergeants and privates that do it, I think are permanently damaged psychologically by it. At the middle grades, captain, lieutenant colonel, this is what I discovered in my Philippine research, and I think there's evidence from other historical instances. What I found in the Philippines, when they used the CIA psychological method, is that you had young lieutenants breaking down their social superiors, priests, professors, sometimes politicians. And so torture as practiced in the Philippines became a transactional experience that destroyed the victim, sometimes for life, and in equal measure expanded the ego of the perpetrator, empowering them. So that for example, the coups against Marcos, the six coups launched by the colonels, they were all former torturers. When the French military tortured systematically in Algeria, what did they do after that? They rebelled against their own government. They tried to assassinate the president of the French Republic, de Gaulle, and they ran a revolt against their own society. In other words, for the middle grade officers, it empowers them, and it breaks down military socialization, and it does real damage to the integrity of military institutions that engage in torture.
Is this a growing debate, or is it a stifled debate in the U.S.?
You mentioned Amnesty. During there were many human rights organizations very active during the 4 years. Amnesty has now launched a major campaign against torture, Amnesty is mobilizing its formidable resources inside the United States. And we are actually now at the start of a major campaign by Amnesty and by related human rights organizations to fight torture and to bring an end to this. Because it's not over. The Bush administration has made it very clear. Right? They have now formalized torture. Okay, before it was done quietly and informally. They are now brazen. They are going to torture. So it's not over.
Thank you, Alfred. Alfred W. McCoy, Professor of History at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. His book is called A Question of Torture, CIA Interrogation from the Cold War to the War on Terror. Oh, it's published by Metropolitan Books, and you'll have to order it from the US. Big change of gear coming up, Alfred, because I'm going to talk about Helen of Troy. But this is Late Night Live on ABC Radio National, Radio Australia, etc. Thanks for coming in, Al.
Thank you, Phil.
I find it very, very hard to begin this segment in the program because I'm in a deep state of shock. Deep state of shock. Helen of Troy, the face that launched 1,000 ships. You won't believe this, Gladys, but that line doesn't come from Helen's era, that was the late Bronze Age, nor did it come from Homer's account of the Trojan Wars. It comes from that upstart Christopher Marlowe from Dr. Faustus, which was written 2,500 years after the Trojan Wars. Now, the idea of Helen's beauty has inspired artists down the centuries. Most scholars see her as mythic, part of the oral mythologies inherited by Homer, as the Greeks busily developed a more literate culture, whereas others think she was a prehistoric nature goddess. Well, you're going to hear some amazing revelations about Helen in the next few minutes. From Bettany Hughes. She's one of the new breed of media-savvy historians who combine research with the more glamorous world of TV documentaries. Helen of Troy is Bettany's first book, and I spoke to her when she was in Australia for the Adelaide Festival. Bettany, welcome.
Thank you very much. Very lovely to be here.
You point out that Helen is a part of the cultural and political makeup of the West. Why has she remained such an enduring figure?
I often ask myself this, and I wonder whether the fact that she is the most beautiful woman in the world, which is, of course, how we remember her, exactly as you've said, the face that launched 1,000 ships. And yet, the tantalising thing about Helen is that we have no idea what she actually looked like. And because of that, she can be every man's, every woman's perfect fantasy. And that's what you see down the ages. So the Roman Helen is a rather matronly figure. In the Middle Ages, there's a Helen who has plucked eyebrows and wears a kind of ridiculous tall hat. And then in our own age, we have the Hollywood Helen, who's recently been in that kind of rather dreadful movie, Troy, who's a simpering blonde pinup. So I think that's partly why, because she fits every age. She can be every person's idea of beauty.
This is hardly of urgent relevance, but I suddenly wonder how popular the name is these days. I think of Helen Mirren, who was always one of my favourite British actors. But there's not that many Helens around now, are there?
Well, you know what, actually, it's a very, very pertinent question, because in fact, if you take all the countries in the world and look at how many women have Greek names or Greek-inspired names, in fact, Helen is the single most popular Greek name there is for a woman, because Helen translates into all sorts of different languages, and there are very, very many Helens, and that's because of Helen of Troy. You know, it's a direct result.
Mm.
Interesting time in Britain in the 17th century, where the church published these pamphlets, and they published a list of names that you should not give your daughter. And top of the list was Helen, because she was such a bad woman, and it was implied that if you called your daughter Helen, you know, she might go to the bad.
I should point out that the subtitle of your book, Helen of Troy, Goddess, Princess, Whore, and Christianized Europe began to see her in the latter way, didn't they, as an adulteress. They were particularly upset at the idea that she had sex on top of, unnatural, deviant, bestial sex.
That's right. There are these amazing accounts written by medieval theologians. And I recently went and looked at the copy of one man's writings called Joseph of Exeter in one of the libraries in Cambridge University. Very beautiful place, very serene and calm. And I was reading this document that was written in the 12th century. And Joseph of Exeter, as with many other monks, was very keen on describing in minute detail exactly how sexually deviant Helen was. And so, of course, he's writing this as if he's putting a dampener on it, and as if he's saying, you know, this is exactly how you shouldn't behave. But, of course, delights in every moment and every descriptive word. And exactly as you pointed out, there's an extremely, I mean, I'm not even going to quote from it because it makes me blush thinking about it, but an extremely vivid depiction of Helen riding on top of Paris in bed, and this being a proof that she was a whore, because it was thought to be the mark of a whore if you had sex on top.
Bettany, we'll do a little edit at this point. Can you just back off the mic a little? You're
yes.
popping, okay?
Yes, sure.
I love little historical fragments that you pick up over the years. One of them was that the prostitutes of Paris used to pay their bridge toll not with a centime, but with a fart. And I noticed that in the late 18th century, Helen was a term of abuse, a flirt, a tart.
That's absolutely right. The playwright Schiller used to popularise this. Anybody who was a Helen was a dreadful creature. But, I mean, the thing is, Helen's had 2,500 years where she's been called a whore. Euripides, the great playwright of the 5th century BC in Greece, calls her a bitch, whore. And Shakespeare calls her a strumpet. Chaucer calls her a queen, which sounds like it's very respectful, but actually, queen at the time that he was writing meant a prostitute or a tart. So she's one of those women that we always imagine that men have loved her, but actually men have loved to hate her down the centuries.
Well, you talk about the post-Homeric misogynist worldview. Can you talk to that?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's very interesting with Helen that I've been researching this book for 15 years, and I have to say, by the end of the research period, I just felt like screaming, kind of leave her alone, you guys. You've all managed to kind of stab in with a knife at some point. But that is not how she was always viewed. Helen was worshipped as a goddess for 1,000 years in the ancient world. She was considered an extraordinarily powerful creature. Women used to go and make offerings to her, and the idea was almost that they could try and acquire some of her extraordinary charisma and her sexual power. And she wasn't demonised. You know, she was respected. There's a beautiful temple that was built to her in Sparta. Beautiful objects are given to her in Egypt. There was a shrine to Helen, and somebody dedicates this absolutely exquisite golden bowl, cosmetics bowl, with her name inscribed around the edge. So the great thing about Helen is that as she travels through time, it's almost as if she's holding up a mirror to the world around her, so that you can understand better the ideas and the prejudices and the loves and the hates of the worlds that she travels through.
One of the things that makes your book intriguing is your argument that she may have really existed.
Cause a bit of a controversy, that. Yeah, that's right. Well, it felt to me that it was the right time to write the book, because at the moment there are amazing archaeological surveys being carried out throughout the Eastern Mediterranean. And what we're realising for the first time, and actually if you know this field of work, it's not controversial at all. There's no question about this. What's emerging out of the earth, I mean, as I speak, there are digs going on, where more and more artefacts are appearing that show that Homer's account of the Trojan War is to a large extent based in historical truth. You know, there's always been this big debate, is it just a poem? Is it a work of imagination? Is it all allegorical? And of course there is poetry there is allegory. Homer is writing about his own world as well as writing about the Late Bronze Age, the time of the Trojan War. But the fantastic thing is, as more and more artefacts appear, we're able to link up lines in Homer with the reality of the Bronze Age. And in particular, we're realising how strong and feisty the women were of the Late Bronze Age. So it suddenly makes sense that Homer composes this epic, and at the centre of the epic is this very troublesome woman called Helen, who is really influencing the world around her.
What was the world around her? What would her hometown have been like in the late Bronze Age?
Yeah, well, Helen, we call her Helen of Troy, but of course she was Helen of Sparta. This is where she lived. She was the queen of Sparta. It would have been a very rich and sensuous life, not, I hasten to add, if you were a peasant or a labourer, but for those aristocrats, it would have been an incredibly rich time to live. You lived hard and died young. Most people were dead by the time they were 28, 29, 30. But when you lived surrounded by jewels and perfumes. We've excavated the graves of some of the women of the time, and they would have dripped with jewellery as they walked around the palaces. And I think for me, researching Helen, one of the biggest shocks was to find out that whereas we had this image of her as a kind of rather pretty blonde pin-up, you know, kind of wafty gold curls blowing in the breeze and a rosy pink dress on, actually, the women of the Late Bronze Age were completely different. These are creatures who are dark-haired. Their hair is dressed so it looks as though they have snakes growing out of their hair. When they're teenagers, they have their heads shaved, so they were like punks almost, you know, the kind of original punk. They wear very fearsome white makeup, white lead makeup over their faces and their arms and their breasts. And their breasts are bare. They have these dresses which are cut away underneath their breasts. And then on their faces, they have red suns tattooed or painted on their cheeks and on their chins, and their earlobes are picked out in red. So as far as you can possibly imagine from those rather romantic pre-Raphaelite sort of chocolate boxy images of Helen, they were certainly women to be reckoned with.
Bettany, I think you're onto something here, a new fashion look. I think that you should talk to McCartney's daughter. She could theme this, couldn't she?
I think that's a great idea. So Stella McCartney doing the real Helen of Troy
yes.
collection.
Yes. You based a lot of your research, I understand, on Hittite texts that were only discovered, well, comparatively recently.
Yeah, that's right. Well, the Hittites were the guys who were in charge of Turkey and much of the Middle East in the Late Bronze Age. And unlike Greece, where we don't have that many written sources, the Hittites were pretty anal, you know. They were great bureaucrats. They wrote everything down. And these sources were only discovered for the very first time in 1905. And they're still being excavated. I was out at digs in the 1980s and we discovered about 3,000 new texts. And there are so many of these things and so few Hittite scholars that 7,000 of them have yet to be translated. So there's a whole wealth of information that's going to come out, which is fantastic. And it was actually looking at one of these things that made me decide to write the book on Helen, because I was excavating out in Hattusha, which is the capital of the Hittite Empire, kind of way out east in Turkey, about 15 hours drive from Istanbul. And out of the earth came this tablet. And on the tablet was written not a story, not a poem, but a verbatim legal account of a negotiation that was being carried out in the Hittite court. And the negotiation revolved around the fact that a young woman had been sent over as part of a marriage alliance to marry a king. And when she gets to the court, she has an affair with somebody. And the two states involved use the infidelity of this woman as an excuse to declare war on one another. And I remember seeing this. I mean, this is only in the 1980s. And just having a heart-stopping moment, not thinking that that is Helen of Troy that's being written about. But this is Helen's story. And it's not fiction. It's not imagination. This is a direct account of a time where a woman has an affair, and as a result, two states use this an excuse to go to war. So it's Helen's story in the late Bronze Age.
Any smoking gun about her actual existence other than Hittite fragments?
Well, no. You see, and this is where, as a historian, I cannot put my hand on my heart and say there was a real Helen of Troy, because until we find a woman's skeleton lying in a grave in Sparta, covered in Trojan gold and with a great
with
big sign.
With a toe tag on it.
With a toe tag saying Eleni. Then and only then can we say we have found Helen of Troy. But what is very exciting is to look at her not just as an icon, not just as this kind of extraordinary femme fatale, this figure of beauty down the centuries, and that's an exciting journey in itself, but to try and wheedle out the roots of her story, which I am certain are based in this very heady time of the Late Bronze Age.
Have you detected a significant difference in the way Helen is remembered in modern-day Turkey compared with Greece?
Well, very interesting, actually. She is definitely held to account for the Trojan War. And if you talk to Turks, occasionally if you mention her name, they spit because she's thought to be a dreadful woman. They're very proud of her in Sparta, in Greece. They're very proud of the fact that she was beautiful. But generally, Greeks, too, don't like her, because as far as the Greeks are concerned, she dragged the whole of their nation into this long, bloody war and kind of humiliated all those heroes involved. So she's still very resonant. And Herodotus, who was described as the father of Greek history, who was writing in the 5th century, he said that Helen was the cause of enmity between East and West, that it was the rape of Helen that resulted in East and West constantly being at each other's throats, and no one's ever forgotten that.
And yet you point out in the book that when Helen was around, if she was around, good and evil were not distinct qualities.
No, that's absolutely right, and it's very interesting. You see, it's how we think. We think exactly as you say, in very polar opposites. An action is good or it's bad. The Greeks didn't think like that. All their gods and goddesses were very flawed. You know, they weren't perfect creatures. They misbehaved terribly. You know, they get drunk and they have arguments and they fight with one another. And Helen is a perfect example of that. She's someone who cannot be pigeonholed, in that she is beautiful, and yet her beauty causes terrible suffering. She brings pleasure, but she also brings pain. And this was an idea that was very important to the Greeks. Eros is obviously the word that gives us erotic and means love in ancient Greek. And Eris is the Greek word that means strife. And the Greeks really thought that these two went hand in hand, you know.
And indeed they bloody well do.
I'd kind of agree with you there.
Well, Bethany, thanks for your time. The book is exuberantly written and lavishly illustrated. It's called Helen of Troy, Goddess, Princess, Whore. I hate saying that. It's published by Jonathan Cape, and Bethany was a distinguished visitor to the Adelaide Writers' Festival. And that, beloved listeners, is it for another week of Late Night Live. Thanks to the team, Sasha Fegan, Paul Gough, Chris Short, Sarah Konofsky and Chris Bullock. Do not forget, I beg of you, classic LNL tomorrow night, or tonight if you're listening to the repeat. Have a terrific weekend. We'll be right back.
ABC Radio National. More than 60 programs, more than 260 transmitters Australia-wide. And we're live on the net as well as media on demand streams. Find out how to get more out of Radio National. Go to abc.net.au/rn. And for the full list of MP3 and podcast programs, abc.net.au/rn/podcast.